Everybody, it's 11 o'clock, and thanks for joining us for the 59th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and if you don't mind, let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Okay, so that was a kind of a deep cut off the one of the double albums Cream put out, the Wheels of Fire record, and it's a song called Politician, since we're talking. Yeah. So since we're talking about various aspects of political propaganda this evening, I thought that would be an incredibly cool dilly to play on the show.
Excellent. Okay, thank you for that. As Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Welcome to the Machine, with apologies to Pink Floyd, The Psychology of Political Propaganda, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis. If you would, sir.
Okay, so tonight I'm going to talk about artists that do covers of other materials and in some cases don't necessarily give proper credentialing to the author. So, I'm particularly focusing on one of my all-time favorite bands, but unfortunately they did do a whole lot of borrowing of other people's material, not necessarily without crediting them, which is a definite no-no under anybody's auspices. So most folks know that, you know, they don't always know who the author of the song is, but you'll, if you look at the record or the CD or whatever, responsible artists who cover other material will have the credits on there of the author and, you know, give them the due credit. So, for example, when Jimi Hendrix covered Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower on the Electric Ladyland recording, which is probably his most well-known song off that record, you know, Bob Dylan's name is on there because he's the author. A lot of people don't know that. When Peter, Paul, and Mary do Bob Dylan songs, they're on there. When they do John Denver songs like Leaving on a Jet Plane, his name is on there. Everybody and their brother has covered the Dave Mason song that he did with Traffic, Feeling All Right. Everybody from Grand Funk Railroad to Three Dog Night, just everybody. And, you know, typically when you see those folks, they will, excuse me, give credit to the author. I mean, I remember seeing Humble Pie in concert who did a Rolling Stone song, and they announced it, you know, purely and simply, and they were, you know, now we're going to do a tribute to the Rolling Stones, and they played a really rocked up version of Honky Tonk Women, did an amazingly killer job of it. I was like, holy moly. So, you know, most artists are pretty good about doing that, but there are some artists who are not so forthcoming, Beach Boys being among them, who stole a Chuck Berry, part of a Chuck Berry song, and put it out, and took him years to get credit for them stealing his song. Well, unfortunately, one of my heroes, Led Zeppelin, has done likewise off their first two recordings. So probably the first two records have four songs that are clear violators of this. And off the first record, the song after the intro song, which is Good Times, Bad Times, and the second song is a tune called Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You, which is very acoustic-y and then gets rocked up. It's one of my favorite tunes off that record. So back in the day, there was a folk singer, late 50s, early 60s, Ann Breeden, who wrote a song called, you know, surprisingly enough, Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You. And it was performed later on by Joan Baez, who I actually have tickets to see next year. She's coming through Atlanta. And
oh, very nice.
So off Zeppelin's first record, they did that song, and under the credits, they had a little notation that said traditional, arranged by Jimmy Page. Well, it might be traditional because it's become traditional after Ann Breeden wrote it and Joan Baez made it famous. However, none of that was ever credited. So their title, some of the melody lines, and some of the lyrics are very, very similar to that. Now, they rocked it up and did all kind of changes that weren't in the original, but they kept enough of the original that they should have they should have credentialed her and given her citations for that. So, or somewhere in the early to mid 1980s, one of Britain's friends recognizes, here's the song, I don't know where that person has been all their lives, but heard the song and went, hey, that's a lot like, and so, you know, reached out to the band and their publisher, and after much haggling and some royalties being paid, a writing credit was added to the previous printings of those records. So you'll see her name on there on future versions of the first recording being printed after that. In a similar vein, probably the most famous song off that recording, which is the last song on the first side, Dazed and Confused. So Jimmy Page did a version of that. And I can't remember if it was called I'm Confused or what it was called, but it was a version of that on that he played live with the Yardbirds. And I always knew that he had taken a lot of this Yardbird stuff and retooled it. But, you know, he was a Yardbird and he wrote a bunch of stuff. So I'm like, okay, no foul. Well, as it turns out, there was a guy in around 1967, which is just prior to the record coming out, because the debut album comes out in 69. And this guy named Jake Holmes had written a song called Dazed and Confused and didn't go to many places. And he soon transitioned to a career in writing jingles, ad jingles. So, you know, Zeppelin puts the record out, puts that song out, then they do a lot of twists and turns, and it also becomes a big hit on their live shows, which it has been for their entire career. But, you know, the title of it, a lot of the lyrics and the descending bass line, you know, the dum, 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 all are direct takeoffs from the John Holmes, the Jake Holmes 1967 song. So in 2010, I guess after much haggling and trying to resolve this issue, he ends up suing the publishing company, and they settle in 2012, and now there's a credit on the record or the CD that says inspired by Jake Holmes, and I'm just like, whatever. But clearly that's, no offense, that's a ripoff, folks. So then we move to the Led Zeppelin II, which also comes out later in 69, I believe, and probably their highest charting record ever at that time, which I think reached like number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100 at the time, was Whole Lotta Love, which is the opening track from that recording. Well, turns out that there was a song originally written by the old blues guy, Willie Dixon, called You Need Love, and was later recorded by Muddy Waters in 62. And so a lot of the medley and some of the song lyrics like You Need Coolin' and Way Down Inside, yeah, Woman, You Need Love, all direct takes from the original song, which was never credited. So finally, there was a lawsuit in 1987, and Dixon's name was added to the credit. So he's now got credit. Willie Dixon has credit for co-authoring that. And finally, the third song on the first side of that record, the Lemon Song, which was written by Chester Burnett. Most people know that blues artist more as Howlin' Wolf. Wrote a song in 1964, I think, or 65, I don't remember. I think it's 64. Wrote a blues song called The Killing Floor. And so, again, there's the riff and the lyrics and the medley and the killing floor phrase used on, you know, I wouldn't be here, my children, down on this killing floor. All of those are, you know, takes from the original Howlin' Wolf Chester Burnett publication. So his folks jumped on that in the early 70s and reached a settlement with the Zeppelin publisher people, and subsequent releases of that have Burnett's name on it. So those were the whole lot of borrowing going on from Zeppelin on the first two records. And, you know, it saddens me to say that because I really love that band. And, you know, the guys are great talents, obviously. But, you know, it just shows to go, yeah, as I say, that even famous people and people with a boatload of talent who have no need to steal shit from other people do so. And sometimes it's unintentional and sometimes it's really, really blatant. And, you know, I'm certainly, you know, far be it from me to say, well, maybe it was just a, you know, I don't know. I just know that it was clearly a violation of some people's writing credential rights. And certainly that's not the only time that's happened. And, you know, since that time and since the Beach Boys days, I mean, you know, Vanilla Ice took a bunch of stuff from Queen and other people, so it's just like, whatever. I mean, you know, the beat goes on, so to speak, for me to steal a line from a Sun and Cher song. But notice, I crack when I make bad jokes. So there you have it. That's my trivia for this evening, and nobody died. So to quote a line from a Pied Du Bois, song, might as well go for a soda and nobody hurts and nobody dies. And in case folks don't know who that is, he's the co-author of Rush's Tom Sawyer.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you for that. Awesome stuff. Okay, so again, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. And feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay, so tonight's show is called Welcome to the Machine, The Psychology of Political Propaganda. Now, many people know the term propaganda, But one of the reasons it is so effective is that a majority of people in our society are not taught what it really means or how not to fall prey to it. We will explain what it is, how it came to be part of our society, and how to recognize it being used on yourselves so that you can take control of your reactions to it and choose freely. So tonight we will discuss first what exactly is propaganda and its history, the basic tools of propaganda and how it works. Three, the expansion on how propaganda functions, you know, a little more crunchy stuff. And then four is conclusions and wrap. And just to be clear, our show will cover topics on occasion that can be politically relevant, but our interest in this is the psychology of it and the mechanic of why this works on us, rather than the material being propagandized. So I just want to make sure you guys are clear on that. We're not deviating from that in any way. So I want to check with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything that you'd like to add before we really get started.
Nope, I'm good. Thanks.
Okay, fabulous. So first, let's talk about what exactly is propaganda and its history. So saying political propaganda is, to a point, somewhat redundant. Propaganda is, by its own definition, typically either about politics and the government or a ruling authority or laws, sometimes about a cause, although ethically most causes have a straightforward agenda. Here is one official definition of propaganda, and I have a couple for you guys, so here's one of them. The source for this is Cambridge University Press, and they say propaganda is information or ideas that are spread by an organized group or government to influence people's opinions, especially by not giving all the facts or by secretly emphasizing only one way of looking at the facts. And now I want to give you guys a bit of a history of its use. It's kind of in two phases. There's the history of propaganda at all ever, and there's a history of modern propaganda as most of you guys know it now, and we'll separate those out. So the history of its use. In the ancient Asiatic civilization preceding the rise of Athens as a great center of human culture, the masses of the people lived under despotisms, and there were no channels or methods for them to use in formulating or making known their feelings and wishes as a group. In Athens, however, the Greeks who made up the citizen class were conscious of their interests as a group and were well informed on the problems and affairs of the city-state to which they belonged. Differences on religious and political matters gave rise to propaganda and counter-propaganda. The strong-minded Athenians, though lacking such tools as the newspaper, the radio, and the movies, could use other powerful engines of propaganda to mold attitudes and opinions. The Greeks had games, the theater, the assembly, the law courts, and religious festivals, and these gave opportunity for propagandizing ideas and beliefs. The Greek playwrights made use of the drama for their political, social, and moral teachings. Another effective instrument for putting forward points of view was oratory, in which the Greeks excelled. And though there were no printing presses, handwritten books were circulated in the Greek world in efforts to shape and control the opinions of men. From that time forward, whenever any society had common knowledge and a sense of common interests, it made use of propaganda. And as early as the 16th century, nations used methods that were somewhat like those of modern propaganda. The term propaganda apparently first came into common use in Europe as a result of the missionary activities of the Catholic Church. In 1622, Pope Gregory XV created in Rome the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith. This was a commission of cardinals charged with spreading the faith and regulating church affairs in heathen lands. A college of propaganda was set up under Pope Urban VIII to train priests for the missions. In its origins, propaganda is an ancient and honorable word. Religious activities which were associated with propaganda commanded the respectful attention of mankind. It was in later times that the word came to have a selfish, dishonest, or subversive association. And the source for that is historians.org by the American Historical Association in a post called The Story of Propaganda. And here are a second definition of propaganda and a related word definition that I want to share with you guys. These are from etymology.com. And according to them, propaganda, the word, the etymology of it began in 1718, related to the story I just told you. A committee of cardinals in charge of Catholic missionary work, short for Congregatio de Propaganda Fide. I hope I said that right. Feel free to correct me if I didn't, Dr. Mathis. Congregation for Propagating the Faith. A committee of cardinals established 1622 by Gregory XV to supervise foreign missions. The word is properly the ablative feminine gerundive of Latin propagare, see propagation. Hence, any movement to propagate some practice or ideology, as of 1790. Modern political sense dates from World War I, and it was not originally pejorative, meaning material or information propagated to advance a cause, and that definition is from 1929. A related word that's important, you guys will see this an awful lot lately, especially in relation to Russian interference in our country, but nobody really knows what it means. So agitprop, A-G-I-T-P-R-O-P, also agit-prop. It's political propaganda in the arts or literature, and that comes from 1938 from the Russian word agitatsiya, A-G-I-T-A-T-S-I-Y-A, agitation. From the French agitation, see agitation, and propaganda, see propaganda, which the Russians got from German. All right, so those are the official definitions of this stuff, and I want to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's any other commentary you want to add.
No, I'm good.
All righty, so the next part we want to talk about, now that we've established our basic terms and the history of how we got here, is the basic tools of propaganda and how it works. Most of these are quite similar to marketing and advertising techniques, so most, if not all, of those also fall into the category of ads that annoy and irritate us. In other words, the tools that we use in this category, if you see them like in commercials or something like that, they're usually the commercials that piss us off, and that's because they're manipulative, frankly, and not really honest. Also, several of these are based on logical fallacies. I did not have time to do what I wanted to do, which was to map them to the different fallacies. But if any of you guys want a copy of the list to go do that on your own, that's fine. I can provide that after the show. So I have a couple of lists here. This first one is from Quizlet.com, which is actually a tool for learning material. So it had these broken down into flashcards. This is a list of common techniques used in modern Western propaganda, as well as marketing and ads. So these are in alphabetical order. The first is assertion, which is an enthusiastic or energetic statement presented as a fact, although it is not necessarily true. Second is bandwagoning, attempting to persuade the target audience to take a course of action. Everyone else is taking, or join the crowd. This technique reinforces people's natural desire to be on the winning side. Bandwagon example, join the winning team, vote for Mrs. Kopp for president. The next method is card stacking, strategy of showing the product's best features, telling half-truths and omitting or lying about its potential problems. Next one is celebrity appeal, which I also think dovetails into testimonials that we'll talk about in a bit. Using a famous person's image to sell products or services or to enroll you in a piece of propaganda by focusing on the person's money, popularity, or fame to promote the product or services, arguing from authority. That's the one I did get to map to a fallacy. The either-or fallacy. A false dilemma is a type of informal fallacy in which something is falsely claimed to be an either-or situation, when in fact there may be at least one additional option. Next is false analogy. In this technique, two things that may or may not be similar are portrayed as being similar. Next is faulty cause and effect. Incorrect reasoning, that concludes that one thing causes another, presuming that a real or perceived relationship between things means that one causes the other. This is a version of correlation is not causality, that sort of thing. Glittering generalities. The act of referring to words or ideas that evoke a positive emotional response from an audience. Virtual words are often used. Generalities example. Every student in Fort Recovery is from a wealthy home. Next is the word impartial. And it's kind of funny being here because it's the only straightforward word in the list. things that are unbiased, fair, neutral, objective, or without prejudice. And I guess this is the rubric by which we judge all the other stuff on the list. Next is name calling, which is the use of names that evoke fear or hatred in the viewer. This technique links a person or an idea to a negative symbol. A name-calling example would be the media is unfair and biased against common people. They are a group of educated morons. Plain folks. The use of everyday people to sell a product or service. Speakers in ads appear to make the person be one of the people. Propaganda. Publicity using certain techniques to evoke an emotional reaction, using half-truth. Testimonial, and that's related to celebrity appeal somewhat. The use of well-known, respected people to endorse a product or service. Quotations or endorsements in or out of context, which attempt to connect a famous or respectable person with a product or item. Testimonial example. You know me, Mrs. Copps. Star of stage, screen, and television, and I'm here to tell you why I'm supporting Mrs. Fullenkamp for governor of Ohio. Transfer, the act of relating something or someone we like or respect with a product. Symbols are constantly used in this form. And last is weasel words, which are deceptive words or phrases added to take away all or part of the meaning of a sentence. I'm going to stop right here and just check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you want to get to, since we have a long list followed by another long list.
I'm good.
Okay. So the next part is another list showing some basic techniques in propaganda. You will hear some repeat concepts from the above list. Now, this list is The Secret History of Political Propaganda by Chloe Mulderig, and this was written August 24th in 2017. And this is from sciencetrends.com. While there are myriad techniques used in propaganda, some are of note in relation to recent changes in the political public sphere. In other words, they're being used quite a bit more often in our society at this time, so they're more relevant. Again, alphabetical list. Ad nauseum. Using ad nauseum techniques, propaganda uses repetition of an idea, word, or image to imprint the desired idea into the mind of the viewer. When politicians focus on staying on message, meaning they repeat the same buzzwords and reinforce the same ideas in multiple public appearances and statements, they are utilizing this technique. Bandwagoning. The goal of bandwagoning is to convince the viewer that everybody is already on board together on a side, and that if the viewer wants to be a winner too, he should jump on board with everyone else. Often the word we is used heavily to imply that everyone is in a situation or group together. Bite-sized tags. Slogans, catchphrases, and taglines are short, catchy, easy to pronounce, and easy to process words or phrases that pack a powerful punch. Particularly in today's social media age of 120 characters and snapshots, bite-sized tags can be a powerful form of viral propaganda because of how easily they can be passed around. By the way, this is not in their notes, but I would observe that hashtags definitely have elevated this to a whole new level. One of the most successful bite-sized tags produced by the British government's propaganda office in 1939 was the poster saying, "Keep calm and carry on." It was never even used out in the general public, but was such a catchy slogan that the poster has found new life as a meme in the 21st century. Common folks. A common propaganda technique in recent years with the rise of populism in the U.S. and Europe has been appealing to common folks. Through the deliberate use of colloquial language and mundane symbols, the goal is to make viewers feel that they directly connect to and can relate to the message or meaning of the propaganda. Demonization. By characterizing an enemy or opponent as monstrous, evil, vile, or dangerous, propaganda can appeal to visceral feelings of fear, disgust, and repulsion. Propaganda which utilizes demonization presents images that are horrifying, hyperbolic, and at times despicably racist or discriminatory. Exaggeration is required, and this technique is particularly necessary for any political smear campaigns.
Or war effort.
Yes, also. Fear-mongering and scapegoating. Perhaps the single most powerful technique in propaganda is the use of fear-mongering, the deliberate use of extreme ideas and symbols for the purpose of swaying opinion by causing deep and at times irrational fear. Often fear-mongering includes scapegoating or blaming bad on a particular group or presenting that group as the root of societal problems. These two techniques are regularly used by xenophobic, racist, authoritarian, and discriminatory groups, parties, and candidates. Flag waving. In increasingly nationalistic times, propaganda which suggests you take actions because it is your patriotic duty. By obeying this message, the propaganda argues, you can show to all just how patriotic you are. This technique has always been used during times of war, yet it is becoming more common in partisan politics in the United States.
Yeah.
Inevitable victory. Because people always want to be on the winning side. If a piece of propaganda can paint a candidate or group's victory as certain or inevitable, then the viewer will want to join the group. Many times there is the use of symbols and words related to destiny or fate. Other times the propaganda will argue that the battle is already all but over, meaning that joining means your place on the winning side is all but a sure thing. Paternalism. Propaganda often appeals to individuals' needs to feel protected and watched over, and employ imagery and symbolism that evokes a sense of paternalism. The emphasis on a strong fatherly authority is appealing to many consuming propaganda, making this technique extremely powerful in times of distress or crisis, such as in the use of Uncle Sam in military propaganda. Not in the notes, but may I add, Big Brother. Thank you, George Orwell. And the last one is the big lie. This strategy requires an entire body of propaganda, usually across multiple mediums, and focuses on stirring up strong emotion by retelling or reorienting a major story or event to change people's perception of the event. By casting recent events in a different light, though we call that a lie, people. Those who produce the propaganda can change the public's emotional associations with what is occurring in their lives. Often this strategy relies on the use of sexist, racist, or xenophobic language and ties together with other techniques like fear-mongering or scapegoating. And last in this section, I have two core principles of propaganda. And these are not sourced as much as they are my distilling of things that I read online on sources about this stuff. The first one of two is appealing to our sense of survival and putting it in jeopardy for the purpose of swaying our actions toward a desired goal we may not have reached on our own power. Propaganda reaches out to our sense of acceptance, belonging, confidence in our own knowledge and self-determination, and ego. These, in turn, ultimately all point back to our sense of survival. Failure to be accepted by community or tribe, or to live by bad data, could result in our being unable to survive somehow by being wrong and causing harm, or by being thought unmutual and being cast out to fend for ourselves apart from the tribe. And the other principle is another key factor is that propaganda is used when facts and reason do not naturally enroll agreement on their own merits. As we mentioned earlier, the original use of propaganda was not so malevolent, but in the last couple of centuries in Western culture, it has become so, as something not based, or at least not fully based. In fact, it instead appeals to our primal and emotional reactions to various concepts and icons. And no matter what its root message, it works by using shaming or judging our worth and value by how much we agree with the message that it imparts. And I'll pause here and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if you want to add anything.
Yeah, what all of these things have in common is they appeal to the limbic system, the amygdala hippocampus, as opposed to the prefrontals, which is the rational, logical brain, in an attempt to bypass that, to short-circuit it so that we act on our basal ganglia, which is our fight-or-flight brain, sometimes known as the quote-unquote lizard brain. And when you think on that terms, that's the thing that mucks all of us up when we act on emotional reasoning as opposed to what I call rational, logical reasoning. And that's what all of these things do. That's the thing they key in on certain national or sociocultural types of icons or images or myths or whatever in order to try to get us to bypass the prefrontal so we're not thinking about the message these people are actually saying or looking at how their actions contradict totally the message that they claim to be purporting. And that's what all of these things have in common.
Okay, perfect. And that's a very good segue to the next part, because one of the first things we're going to talk about is all the three different parts of the brain.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yes. So expansion on how propaganda functions. This is essentially a bit more about what we were talking about in number two, but now we're going to get into some crunchy detail. And I want to give credit to large chunks of these notes to Mark Shapiro, who is very fond of this subject and has done a lot of research, which he was happy to share with me. And I am now sharing with you guys. So to understand why propaganda exists and why it takes the forms it does, we first need to explore the human condition since we're the targets of it. And therefore, the most effective propaganda will be the kind that affects us in the broad sense the most. This all starts by remembering how our brains function, since they are the targets to receive and process these messages. So the brain has three basic areas, as Dr. Mathis was just saying. The basal ganglia, or lower brain, also called the lizard brain or the reptilian brain, they're all referring to the same parts. This controls vital, unconscious life functions like breathing, body temperature, our sense of balance, and to an extent, primal reactions such as fight or flight, as well as species-typical instinctual behaviors involved in aggression, dominance, territoriality, and ritual. The next part is the paleomammalian complex, or the limbic brain, and this is where we make value judgments. And this contains the hippocampus, the amygdala, and the hypothalamus. It regulates hunger, it regulates hunger, sexual response, and parenting instincts. This is also an area targeted by propaganda because it affects emotional response.
Yeah, let me add something real quick.
Yeah.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but let me add something really quick. The other thing that makes this so powerful is that the hippocampus is not only one of the seats of emotional expression, it's also the memory complex. And so if you have an emotional memory that you can tie into the hippocampus, it's like a flashbulb memory. It almost goes away. It's the thing that gets triggered with PTSD as well. So if you get something that's really locked into the limbic system, particularly with the hippocampus, the emotional memory thing, it is really hard to unwire that bad puppy. You can do it, but it takes a lot of work, and it's so reflexive almost that people do it without knowing they're doing it, and then when they catch themselves, they're already into it, and most people don't even catch themselves doing it. So that's the other thing that makes this thing so powerful.
And that's a very good point, because the purpose of us gesturing at this is that people can often get as far as realizing this is going on. But the other part, we don't have any easy answers for, is how do you make it stop? And when you realize that, it's kind of like, how do you make PTSD stop? You kind of can, but there's always a lingering thing because it's imprinted so damn hard in there. And this is why. So that's very important. Thank you for adding that.
Sure.
So the last part that of the brain that we want to talk about, the third area, is the neomammalian complex or the neocortex, which is only in higher mammals and regulates language, abstract thinking, planning, and other complex thought function. And this is probably the part of your brain that will attempt to talk you out of the propaganda if it's enrolling you in something you don't like.
Yeah, that's the prefrontal cortex part. Yep.
Yep. So human society and community, as we now know it, is a relatively new concept. And we as humans are still to a large extent governed by the primal instincts. Fear being the most succinct, useful, and universal. So most propaganda caters to fear. You may wonder, fear of what? Fear of anything, though other, and you know, that which is other, not of your tribe or your community, is again the most conveniently used. But fear of loss of safety or resources is another one, as well as fear of harm or death from being cast out. Advertising also caters to these fears and anxieties, though they do so in a smaller scope way. They're trying to get you to buy a product rather than an ideology. And one might make a case that many products are sold as a vital part of an ideology, but we covered this in our episode on marketing back in episode 52, with the psychology of advertising and marketing in September of 2018. They use many of the same tactics. They deliberately establish a fear rather than play to an existing and not fabricated fear. And this is advertising does this. They'll establish a fear and then promote the item or the ideology being sold as a solution to that fear. Whereas propaganda
so
often looks for fear that are, yes, propaganda often looks for a fear that is already there and then pokes at the bear. So anyway, the second part of human nature that propaganda exploits is humans' natural inclination to tell stories. And by this, we don't mean fiction or oral history, but more our assumptions and justifications about what we see and hear, our judgments and interpretations. We do this because it's kind of the blessing and curse of our higher consciousness. Human beings are always making stories up naturally, generally unconsciously. In your head, you're going, that guy looked at me funny. He must not like me. Or every time I wear my lucky jersey, my football team wins. Or we need to fight for freedom over there so that we can protect our freedom over here. Sometimes the stories are useful or even factually correct, but that doesn't stop them from being stories, internal propaganda in essence. So we extrapolate and we fill in missing data. Now, I'm not an evolutionary psychologist or an anthropologist, but if I had to invent a story of my own about why we're constantly doing it, I'd say it's because the ability to create stories enabled us to pass along certain kinds of survival lessons to our offspring long ago without having to expose them to danger directly. We could tell them a story to teach them a lesson about one day Grog wandered out too far in the woods and was eaten by a tiger. If we were good enough at telling it, the recipients would actually be there, imagining it, and learning from that experience without actually having to go through with it. Unfortunately, when you combine storytelling with the lizard brain and you're not conscious of either one, well, then you end up creating all sorts of weird toxic stories that get handed down and also erode, like in the modern party game of telephone.
Yeah, sometimes, if you don't have instincts, that's what you do. You tell stories.
Yes. Sometimes these stories or assumptions are true, and so it plays on our fears that ignoring them could mean not getting valuable data. This fear fuels our reluctance to question stories that feed another fear-based reaction, confirmation bias. The stories tell us our assumptions are true, and we don't want to lose that and become wrong or worse. So now that we have an understanding of the human condition in this regard, we can talk about how propaganda exploits that. So given the terms we've described above, propaganda is essentially a particular story, and in the sense that we just talked about, designed to promote a particular set of values that's designed to leverage the lizard brain to get people to buy in on an unconscious level and then act in a way you want. The story is generally crafted very carefully with an eye towards maximizing the communication of the values through the story, while at the same time playing up the perceived risk so that regardless of whether or not the conscious mind of the recipient agrees, the lizard brain is forced to at least acknowledge the inherent threat. A classic example of this is a lot of the more effective wartime propaganda from World War II, where advertising execs, who just so happened to be pioneering this method at the time, got a chance to hone their craft on behalf of the United States. You know, the posters that we had, like somebody talked, or, you know, the Rosie the Riveter posters and these kinds of things. So why does this work better on people than just telling them your point flat out? Why is the story more enrolling? Because when it comes to stories, sometimes less is more. If the recipient fills in the blanks themselves, remember how we said earlier we like to fill in gaps on our own, then they feel a sense of personal ownership of that story. It's not a thing someone else told them. It's something that they, quote, came up with on their own. It is a form of self-delusion. Just telling someone the point flat out engage the intellectual part of the brain, that third part we talked about, but doesn't engage the primal part, not nearly as much as a good story does. And it's the primal part, at the end of the day, that still tends to drive behavior in humans. The more cognitive parts are usually just creating more stories to explain and justify why the primal parts are, quote, running them. Why it's okay for them to cheat on their spouse or shoot that guy or whatever they're up to. The knee-jerk reaction takes to influence. It's more powerful and often is already happening regardless of whether the person is aware of it, because it's a lizard brain autonomous reaction. The most common themes that get leveraged in a lot of classic American propaganda were us versus them, social solidarity, pull your weight, earn your keep, and borrowed prestige. Maybe for some reason you aren't able to join our brave soldiers aboard, the story says, but by contributing in production and making the means for them to do their job, you are playing your part. You count. You matter. It makes me want to go out and buy a t-shirt and a coffee mug now. This appeals to the positive sense of safety, contributing to the tribe, like we discussed earlier. It also has the added bonus of squelching the ideas of labor revolt against industry and capital business owners by advocating that they both work for the same team. If there's any conflict, and given the nature of the power imbalance, it would be labor unhappy with management. Then there's the secondary story of, you must not want to see our soldiers succeed because you're unwilling to sacrifice for them. They're sacrificing for you. This is still seen today in peacetime, despite economic turmoil and extreme income disparity. Interestingly, and as kind of a segue, other propaganda in other nations cater to this as well. Classic communist propaganda in Russia pushed that button heavily, which is ironic because of the level of starvation and general resource loss that ensued as a result of poor management practice by the states. In other cases, the threat is very literal. ISIS, Daesh, the Taliban propaganda about doing your part in rejecting Western culture and assuming traditional gender and family roles to ensure compliance with Allah's word, or we'll come to your house and shoot you, or worse. Same levers that it's pulling on, different stories being told to leverage them. Compliance with what they tell you is Allah's word. And if any of you are familiar with the Quran, you will realize that, like Christian fundamentalists, it's twisting what's actually there. East versus West. So because of the differences in Far Eastern cultural values compared to Western cultural values, the same levers again are used, but much different approaches and stories. Since there's already an extremely heavy social bias towards tribalism and lack of individuality in a lot of those cultures that is baked into everyday interaction, they don't have to actively press on that fear as much as we do in Western society. Instead, a lot of Chinese and to a certain extent some Japanese propaganda establishes a kind of grand, glorious vision of what is supposed to be. And then There's inherent or explicit, in the case of the Communist Revolution, cultural pressure to try to meet that standard. Propaganda in these cases tends to be softer in nature because the pressure to conform comes from the societal rebound against failing to meet the high expectations advertised by the propagandizing bodies. Now note that this is from an internal perspective. When it comes to external propaganda designed to sway other nations, China has been taking an increasingly Western approach, which makes a certain degree of sense given its target is a more Western audience. And you see a lot of people talking about disinformation campaigns, DESA, that sort of thing, and they're trying to instigate arguing in the Western countries. They want us to be arguing and tearing each other apart because we're doing their job for them. That's one of the classic moves. We do want to make the obvious point here that propaganda has become a concern for everyone in our country because of the political climate of the last 2 years. It certainly has been going on the entire time in our country, but these days it is far more flagrant, extensive, and aggressive than in the past, and it behooves us all to recognize its many forms and their effects on us. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Math, and see if there's anything you want to add here.
Yeah, what I would say is the key here is that anytime somebody's emotional brain gets triggered and they have this emotional hippocampal type memory, whether it's subconscious or which they're aware of, connection with something, and they get triggered to act and, oh my God, and give money or join this cause or whatever. I tell everybody, take 5 minutes out. Nobody's going to die in the 5 minutes it takes you to take a breath and examine what people are asking you to do to see, is this reality or is this a fantasy that somebody is creating for their own benefit and not for yours? So, you know, if you can cut off, if you can recognize the emotional component coming up in you and put a lid, as I call it, on your id, and yeah, go to the executive brain, the prefrontal lobes, the neocortex, and really analyze the rationale and the logic behind it, you will often be able to overcome your initial urge to react as opposed to thinking it through. That doesn't mean you're not going to occasionally react because, you know, none of us are perfect. But the more times you stop yourself and make the cognitive connection, the rational connection, the more neural networks you're making, the easier it'll be for you to put a lid on that emotional initial reaction and manage your behavior and see the fallacies in all of these appeals to your emotion as opposed to reason. And you use the same process when you're dealing with PTSD folks as well.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Thank you for that. So in conclusion, we hope our listeners have a deeper understanding of what exactly propaganda is now, why and how it works, and how to keep your own reactions to it in check and not allow it to run or manipulate you. And I'm going to check in, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you want to add about any of the sections we talked about tonight.
No, I just want to say that, you know, this is just another way to, you know, that most people have heard me say many times before, this is a way of taking your power back. Right? Everybody in the sound of my voice has the ability to do this. You just, you think about it, you look at the rationale, and you go with just, you know, you pull the Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am, and get rid of the emotional reaction stuff. And 99% of the time, you're probably going to make the right decision as opposed to doing something stupid on emotional appeal as opposed to rational appeal. You're going to be much better off. And in the long run, you're going to feel better about yourself. You're going to create much better, much more solid neural pathways that will also help you in times when you get stressed out, when you get angry, when you want to make an impulsive buy. Same process. Once you start to create those pathways that allow your prefrontals to run your emotional brain, you're benefiting in a numerous areas of your life, not just this one or two areas. So that's the real cool thing about this. It's a good generalizable tech tactic that you can use to take back a lot of portions of your life.
Excellent. Okay, thank you for that. So it is getting close to midnight, and this concludes our show on the psychology of political propaganda. So we hope our listeners now better understand how this method works and can recognize their own relationship with the process. Maybe, that's a line for the charity stuff. I'm sorry, I didn't strike that from the script. So I'm not going to read you this next part. It doesn't matter. At any rate, you know, like we said earlier, you can recognize how propaganda works, how it works on you in particular, you know, what your hot buttons are and how things are appealing to that, and step back and realize they're doing this because they want you to do a thing, and it's not a thing you were naturally doing on your own. And this process is pretty much never fully truthful about what it's up to. So you should automatically be suspicious of these things and take your own power back. Alrighty, so on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, I want to thank our listeners this evening and also give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later through podcasts, iTunes, etc. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks on Wednesday, January 9th at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on blogtalkradio.com. We also want to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of days. Friday, December 28th, we have Return to Battlestar Galactica. Join Admiral Roger D. Noriega as he returns to the award-winning television series Battlestar. So say we all. Roger will have a doubleheader this coming Friday afternoon or morning for you West Coast listeners. He will be covering four different episodes of BSG at both 7 and 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. So that'll be just before lunch for us. Monday, December 31st, Monday Night in America, New Year's Eve finale. We're blowing out 2018 with Roger Noriega, 7 Pacific Standard Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. He'll be talking about 2018 with his listeners for 2 hours up until the ball drops in Times Square back here on the East Coast. And future note, Sunday, February 10th, for those of you who follow or want to follow my other show on this network, The Walking Dead Online Viewing Party returns for Season 9, Episode 9, which is called New Enemy, and that's the mid-season opener. So join us at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time to catch up on what we've missed since Thanksgiving and discuss what is to come in the back half of Season 9 of The Walking Dead. So please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on.